Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. Life can be tough for kids in New Mexico's foster care system. In fact, a lawsuit brought against the state in 2018 alleged that New Mexico's child welfare practices systematically re-traumatize vulnerable children by severing them from contact with extended family members and their community, shuffling them from home to home, not providing adequate mental health care, and not considering factors like tribal enrollment when placing kids with families. But that all may be changing for the better. Last year, New Mexico's Children, Youth, and Families Department agreed to a legal settlement that by 2023 would radically reform how kids in New Mexico's foster care system are treated. On this week's Let's Talk New Mexico, we'll be taking a look at those reforms and how the state is doing with implementing them. We'll talk to plaintiffs in the original lawsuit, young people who came out of the foster care system, and organizations that support foster kids in our state. And we want to hear from you. Are you or have you been a kid in a foster home? What was the experience like? Or are you a foster parent? What do you think works or doesn't work with the system as it's currently operating? You can give us a call at 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Now, my first guest is Therese Yannin of the Native American Disability Law Center. Good morning, Therese.
Good morning, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So in 2018, the Native American Disability Law Center was one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the Children, Youth, and Families Department that alleged that New Mexico's foster care system was harmful to many of the children it was intended to protect. How and why did that lawsuit come about?
The lawsuit was the result of a realization that many times attorneys for children and families in the abuse and neglect system were asking for services from the state that did not exist. And district court judges, family court judges were in a tough position where they could not order something that didn't exist. The Law Center has represented Native American children in San Juan County in abuse and neglect cases for about the past 10 years. And we became a plaintiff in the case, and one of our clients was a named plaintiff, in order to address some of the real gaps in services and the weaknesses that we saw. The other plaintiffs, the other organizations and children in the case were really trying to address the systemic failure of the state to provide a comprehensive statewide community-based support. We really feel that as a community, when the state takes a child into custody, we have an obligation to care for that child and not just process them. We have an opportunity and an obligation to serve them and to address their needs, not just place them where it's convenient. And currently, there are insufficient services, and those that exist are often fractured or uncoordinated. Frequently, in my experience, I think children really feel like they're a burden. Mm-hmm. They're a burden to the system. They're a burden to families. They're a burden just in general. And I think it's our obligation as the adults in the system to ensure that they have what they need. And we can do better. These children deserve the love and attention that all children do. And as a state, the lawsuit was intended to focus our resources to better care for children across the board. In the settlement, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you mentioned services that were being requested that the state was not able to provide. Can you tell me about what some of those were?
We frequently had difficulty, since we were representing Native children, we frequently had difficulty accessing culturally appropriate services, traditional healing ceremonies, traditional rites of passage, such as the Canalda in the Navajo community. And there would be frequently the state would say we could provide it, and then nothing would happen that for it to actually occur. Our focus was on keeping children close to home and close to their families in the same schools so that their education wasn't disrupted. Because of a lack of appropriate services and a lack of appropriate supports, especially in the rural parts of the state, many times children were moved from district to district and frequently not just 15 miles away, but 150 miles away. Because of the state's because of the concentration of services in Bernalillo County and in the Albuquerque region, many times we have clients that are down in Albuquerque, which disrupts their ability to maintain their relationships with their community, and more importantly, with their family. Mm-hmm. And so what we're really focusing on is making sure that the services are available across the state and that children are not moved any more than necessary, and that they remain in their school districts and the schools that they were originally placed in. The more often you move a child, the more often they move schools, the further behind they get in school.
Mm-hmm. Does it have other effects on them besides, like the falling behind in school?
I think that it's really disruptive for them emotionally. Mm-hmm. How, we all take time to build relationships with people. If we have, we frequently have clients that over the course of years have 15 or 16 placements. How are they supposed to, feel a part of a community or feel a part of a home when they're being moved so frequently? Mm-hmm. We currently have a client who's been moved 3 times in the last 180 days. Oh. And it's just, there's a disruption for their services. There's a disruption in their relationships. I personally can't imagine what it must be like for a young person to try and build a relationship and a rapport with foster parents repeatedly, much less therapists or social workers. I think it's frequently very sad when the most consistent adult in a person's life is their attorney. Mm. And as a youth attorney and guardian ad litem, I have frequently been the most consistent person in that young person's life.
Now, as you mentioned, Native American kids in particular can face a lot of challenges in the foster care system. And at least prior to the lawsuit settlement, the state did not prioritize placing them in foster care families from their own cultural background. Could you describe why that's so important for kids from Native communities?
Well, there's a federal law called the Indian Child Welfare Act, mm-hmm. Which requires states to place children with their Native families and with Native within their Native community, unless there's good cause not to. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, from my experience watching the process, frequently the process that families are asked to go through is very arduous and culturally inappropriate, mm-hmm. and not very culturally sensitive. And so there are opportunities for families to provide placements for their nieces, nephews, grandchildren, that are missed because of the way the system is set up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's especially essential because of the connections that people have. So instead of being placed with a stranger, they're being placed with their aunties mm-hmm. or their grandparents, people that they'll have a long-term connection with. There's also a way of grounding the child. For Native children, it's a way of grounding them in their culture and in their tradition. It's their sense of identity. Mm-hmm. The Indian Child Welfare Act was the result of studies and analysis in the 60s that showed the huge impact on Native children because they were so disproportionately both taken into custody and placed with predominantly white families. And it results in just incredible harm to the child because they don't have that sense of connection mm-hmm. with their community. And so it's very important for these children to have access to their traditions, to their ceremonies, to their language. I have a old friend who's a fluent Navajo speaker, and his feeling was that without having that grounding in the language and in the community, it's just really hard to be Navajo. Mm-hmm. And so it's just essential for these children and for their long-term well-being to have that grounding in their community.
So if the Indian Child Welfare Act, I mean, this is a federal statute that is supposed to, like you said, prioritize placement of Native kids with Native families or culturally appropriate places, is supposed to protect them. Why didn't it?
I think that it's up to It's up to the child's lawyers and to the parents' lawyers to push those issues. There's no outside enforcement mechanism, and so it's essential to have people raising the question.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it gets back to if the process isn't working, if there's not an appropriate way of licensing family, or if there aren't native foster families, then the court can't order something that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, we've had two contested hearings within the last year arguing that the department was not appropriately treating a grandparent and treating that grandparent as an appropriate placement for the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is up to the children's lawyers and to the parents' lawyers to push the issue.
So since the settlement last year, have you seen changes in how the system operates?
There are, I think, some things that are going well, and there are some things that are still concerning.
Mm-hmm.
The state has addressed out-of-state placements.
Mm-hmm.
When the settlement was agreed to, there were over 150 New Mexico children placed out-of-state. When they're placed out of state, it's more difficult to keep track of how they're doing. It's more difficult to maintain connections with them to make sure that they're safe. And over the past year, I believe the number's less than 30 right now.
Okay.
And so there has been progress on that.
Mm-hmm.
There has also been progress on developing high fidelity wraparound services, which are about coordinating necessary community-based services to help children and family address their needs while staying together and making sure that they have what they need in the community.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been some progress on developing new protocols on the use of psychotropic medication and implementing a child adolescent needs and strengths crisis assessment tool so that the child's needs are identified very early. I think the state is also working on improving their data system. I think that that's been a slow process, but I think things are improving. I think the reliable, verifiable data is essential to moving forward. Some of the concerns we have are still around providing culturally appropriate services and interventions for children and providing appropriate placements and really improving the training for staff.
That makes sense.
And so I think that while there are some things that are going well, there are some things that are still very concerning for us.
Okay. Well, my next guest will be able to speak quite a bit more about that. He is Brian Blaylock, the Secretary of New Mexico's Children, Youth, and Families Department. Good morning, Brian. I'm glad to have you on.
Hey, good morning, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So we are going to have to go to a break in a moment here. But before we do, can you just give me a sense of how big the state's foster care system is? How many kids are placed in foster homes?
Sure. So at any given time in New Mexico, we usually have around between 2,000 and 2,300 kids in the child welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
And then additionally to that, we have about 1,000 kids that are on formal probation through CYFD. Those are kids that are in the juvenile justice system. And then about a third of those kids are living with non-parents.
Okay, I see. So like I said, we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman, and we'll be back in a moment.
Support comes from the Los Alamos National Laboratory Fellows, presenting Frontiers in Science, Protecting the Power Grid with Physics with Raymond Newell, online on Wednesday, May 26th at 6 p.m. Info at lanl.gov/museum. Support comes from Canteen Brewhouse. Locally brewed beer, growlers, crowlers, six packs, and root beer are available. Dine in and carry out Monday through Thursday, 2 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 9, and Sunday, noon to 8, available. CanteenBrewhouse.com.
Christina Cutts Doherty says the tuba is capable of anything.
Tuba players, we're just kind of figuring out how to play it still, but we're going to take over.
Our first tuba player is a PT young artist. Christina Cutts Doherty joins me on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the state's foster care system. Have you been or are you currently in a foster placement? Tell us about your experience. You can give us a call at 277-5866. Right now, I'm talking to Therese Yannin of the Native American Disability Law Center and Brian Blaylock, the Secretary of New Mexico's Children, Youth, and Families Department. This morning, we've been discussing what's known as the Kevin S. lawsuit, which made a number of allegations against the state's foster care system, stating, among other things, that it re-traumatized the children under its care. So one thing that happened, Brian, is that during the previous governor's administration, Governor Susana Martinez, the state disputed the allegations in the Kevin S. lawsuit. But after the transition to Governor Lujan Grisham, the state settled pretty quickly. Why is that?
Yeah, thanks, Ty. It's a great question. I think looking at the three legal claims in the Kevin S. lawsuit and looking at what was happening for the last 10 years before this administration came in 2019, I think it would be difficult to dispute the allegations that were there. Mm-hmm. One of the allegations was related to not providing sufficient or appropriate community-based mental health services under the Medicaid EPSDT entitlement that our kids have. And I mean, you know better than me, because a lot of that, this happened before I got here to the state in 2019, but with the shakeup and running community mental health services out of business in the state of New Mexico, when we came in 2019, we simply did not have enough services for our children or our families. I think a second legal claim was related to compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act, which Therese just did an awesome job explaining. And I think when we came on board, the relationships that we had with tribes was very strained. And our practices did not prioritize culturally relevant services or connecting those young people to their family members as we're required to do under federal law, under ICWA. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the third legal claim really is about being sure that children are able to stay in placements that are as family-like as possible. And that's, you know, a lot of that is bringing kids home from out of state, which Therese already mentioned, how we have that number now below 30, which is great. But the second component of that for us is relatives, relatives, relatives. I mean, the relatives are the backbone of any healthy child welfare system. And in January of 2019, the state of New Mexico placed children who were first coming into our care with relatives 4% of the time. That is incredibly low. Mm-hmm. It's kind of difficult to imagine how we were doing that that poorly. Last month, we actually placed children with relatives when they were first coming into care at 46%, which I think is a good indication of where we should have been all along.
Right. So does this indicate a different vision, like a fundamentally different vision for the direction of the foster care program?
Yeah, I mean, as you probably know, I'm a lawyer. I have a legal background. And so I would say the change of direction is probably twofold. First is that we see the legal entitlements that children have when they come into our care as important things that we need to comply with. Because there's great value. I mean, there's reasons that that exists. I mean, the Indian Child Welfare Act, for example, since its implementation in the 70s, is now considered to be the gold standard of child welfare because of how much attuned it is with those cultural connections and all of the things we know about what helps children thrive is ensuring that they're connected to their culture and their families, which is so important. And then the second thing I think is maybe a little bit of a culture shift is just a real focus that our agency has on strengthening communities and our families and ensuring that when we're working with children, we are absolutely as a baseline, not doing anything to re-traumatize them or cause more adverse childhood experiences, but also really proactively working and strengthening the family, because long-term, that's what's going to be good for our kids.
Okay. And Therese Yannin of the Native American Disability Law Center, I want to ask you real quick, you talked a bit about some of the policy changes that you've seen. Have you noticed this cultural shift that that Brian's talking about in your dealings with the state?
I am not seeing it here in San Juan County.
Okay. So, Brian, what's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we've been saying is let's look at the data to see how we're doing, because data helps us figure out things. And as my friend and colleague Secretary David Scray says, the plural of anecdote is not data. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at data, I think we can see that we're turning the corner on some key metrics. I mean, I mentioned the kinship care placement rate. I should also say that we had a four-year plan that hit 40%. That's we thought it was going to take us 4 years to do it. We hit 40% about 7 months ago. And like I said, last month, we're at about 46%. Overall kinship care placements is around 38%. And so we're getting close to that 40% marker as well. Mm-hmm. The out-of-state placements is also good. But one of the things that I love that Therese talked about earlier, which is so true, is placement stability. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the markers of a healthy foster care system is whether or not children are able to get to a place and stay there, because multiple placements is so disruptive to schools and the overall well-being of our children. And last year, so March of 2020, our placement change rate was over 6.3. And right now, and we've seen a steady decline. And so where we are this month is around, is under 5. It's about 4.6.
Okay.
And that's good growth. Is it where we want to be at the end? No, we want to get it to 3 or below, but we got a long ways to go. And so I think a lot of our data is showing that, like, really good, demonstrable, like, empirically verifiable progress. And we absolutely have a lot of work to do, because the state of the system, what we inherited in January of 2019, I think was far from what we needed and what our families needed.
Can you tell me about why CYFD might change a child's placement? What are some of the reasons?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not a child's placement changes should be predicated on what's in the best interest of the child. Mm-hmm. And that's something that should be at the forefront of any decision-making when we're considering it. Different things can happen, but two things that I'll point to that leads to a lot of high placement change. The first one is the thing that I just mentioned, mm-hmm. where if we place with a non-relative foster home, it is much more likely, statistically speaking, that placement will change. Relatives tend to hang on to children more. Mm-hmm. They tend to stick with them, and those placement numbers seem to be lower. And so we think one of the reasons why our placement change numbers are decreasing is because we're just doing a better job connecting those children with more appropriate placements to begin with. The second is community-based mental health services. I mean, children mm-hmm. in New Mexico per capita have four or more adverse childhood experiences than any other children in the country. Our children have experienced a ton of trauma, and as a result, they really benefit from having somebody to talk to. Or depending on their age, it might be someone to play with, like play therapies, therapeutic mm-hmm. play intervention. And as I mentioned before, when this administration came in, we were working at a deficit because we simply did not have the community-based mental health services we needed. We've been doing a ton of work with HSD and the leadership of Secretary Scrise and Dr. Neil Bowen over there to rebuild those behavioral health care services as quickly as possible, because a child should never have to move placement in order to get more appropriate treatment. Mm-hmm. The more appropriate treatment should come to the child. And we don't have that system yet in the state of New Mexico, but we are building it as quickly as we can. And we've made some inroads, especially in some of our communities.
Can you tell me what that will look like and when you expect that process to be completed?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're building community-based mental health services. We've increased, for example, infant mental health by about 100% since 2019. We've increased high-fidelity RAP by even more than that since 2018. But what it'll look like for the family is, if there's a child who's exhibiting behaviors, acting out, and it's threatening to undermine that placement stability. In other words, that ability for that child to stay in their home with those people who love them, who are working with that youth, we can refer and get that youth services that will come to the home or wherever the child is comfortable. I mean, it could be the home, could be the football field, could be the school, in order to work with them. One of the services that's a great example of that is multisystemic therapy. It's a short-term intensive treatment that's really designed to help youth develop their own mechanisms or their own coping strategies in order to stop any sort of problematic behaviors and just to kind of eliminate stress. And so multisystemic therapy is great because we know it worked in New Mexico. We used to have a lot more of it before the shakeup under the last administration. Mm-hmm. And so we've been building that in different communities. It's awesome for especially older youth. To help them develop those kind of coping mechanisms that we all need in order to be able to deal with stress.
Now, we are talking about New Mexico's foster care system today, and we'd love to hear from you. Are you someone who went through a family disruption as a child? What sources of strength did you draw on to get through it? What do you think people should know about kids who are going through something similar? Give us a call at 277-5866 and tell us about it. And Brian, back to you. I wanted to ask, Therese mentioned the harm that can result from Native kids being placed with families from outside their culture, even in terms of like having appropriate ceremonies for their cultural background. How are those things being addressed right now?
Yeah, you know, we've when we came in 2019, there was some really great leadership happening in the second district. Judge Begay, who was a special master then, and Judge Ward, had really identified issues with ICWA compliance in the state of New Mexico, and it developed a specialty court that was around the Indian Child Welfare Act. What we did in response is we created our own ICWA unit. And so we have staff now that specialize in ICWA, attorneys who specialize in ICWA, and then we just have a tremendous tribal affairs director, Donna Lynn Saraceno, who is providing staffing and being sure that those services are able to be connected to those kids, because I couldn't agree with Truth more. I think that's exactly right. When youth come to us and come into our care, it's so important that we be sure that they're staying connected to family and staying connected to their culture, because we know ultimately that's what helps build resiliency and helps them be able to recover from traumatic instances.
Now, Therese Yannon of the Native American Disability Law Center, I want to ask you, if you could have one reform, just prioritize one reform right now and make it happen kind of more or less instantly, what do you think would be the most important thing to change right now about the foster care system?
Ty, that's virtually an impossible question to answer. I really agree with Brian that the focus on the kids and the focus on the data is really important. I think while our focus here at the Law Center is on the needs of Native children, all children across the state need statewide community-based services. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be an essential piece.
Statewide community
but
services.
That also goes hand in hand with stable, appropriate placements. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to just pick one piece that's the essential piece, because there's a connectedness between the elements of what the settlement is trying to address. And so it's difficult to look at the components of the system or the components of the settlement and separate them out. Because it's somewhat like a net, a safety net for these kids to catch them when they're at their most vulnerable and just meet their needs and care for them. I frequently look at a situation and think to myself, is this something that would be okay for a child in my family? Mm-hmm. And it's not. And I think that's what the goal should be. Is that we are, as the adults in this community and in this state and as adults in this system, we are the ones that are stepping in and taking care of these children and giving and making sure they have what they need, just like we would for children in our own family. And so I think that a key piece of that is going to be those stable placements and that a statewide system of community-based services. I couldn't agree with Brian more. Kids should not have to go hundreds of miles away to get their needs met.
Thank you. It looks like we have a call from Cheryl in Albuquerque. Good morning, Cheryl. What would you like to add to today's conversation?
I would like to say that family matters more than anybody. You know, there are great foster parents out there, and I'm not trying to put them down. I just think that when they're with family, not all family is perfect, you know. And they tell me that CYFD holds to a higher standard. And I think they should. I really do. But I got a speeding ticket. And I was that I didn't take care of because I was busy with the children. Mm-hmm. And I honestly forgot about it. I take responsibility for that. I got pulled over. I went to jail overnight, and they removed all of my grandchildren from my home. They took my license away, you know, and I think that's extreme. Mm-hmm. These kids have been in foster care for 5 years.
Yeah.
And they just can't seem to get it together. It, to me, it seems like they're looking for excuses to pull them from me. Mm-hmm. Nobody will take these kids. They have behavioral issues that are beyond out of control. CYFD has not been able to hook me up with anyone to help me with those behavioral issues. I do the best I can. I'm grandma. That's all I can do.
Well, that's a really hard situation, and I want to thank you for calling in and sharing that with us today. Brian, I feel like what Cheryl was talking about, there certainly is a common perception that CYFD will just swoop in and take kids away under what might be situations that can be solved in other ways. Is this something that's maybe changing at the state level?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of checks and balances that, you know, when they're working to avoid situations like that. And honestly, you know, in a foster care case, there's always competing perspectives, always in every single case. And you'll see that in a lot of the policy discussions. I mean, in the legislative session just now, there was people who, you know, very enthusiastically thought that CYFD was removing children too soon and too early. There were other people who were urging policies saying CYFD was not removing children fast enough. And so I think, you know, balancing that and just ensuring that we have really good rubrics when we look at things, and that there are appropriate checks and balances to be sure that when we remove a child, which is a very, very serious intervention, that we are only doing it because we absolutely have to, because that child cannot possibly be safe in that home. And then we're doing everything we can to support that child to return to the home and provide services. I also say, and this gets back to the earlier question of culture shifts, one of the things we've learned, especially with older youth, it's been very humbling for CYFD in the last 2 years, is listening to those older youth as we're involved in those very complicated decisions that massively impact their lives. They have a lot of wisdom and a lot of perception that we, I can't say, historically have done a good job taking into account. And we're doing a much better job dialoguing with those youth and dialoguing with those kin caregivers as well, to see how we can help, and really shifting that conversation from, you know, what's wrong, what have you done, and what kind of intervention do we need, and shifting to instead, what's happened and how can we help?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't think of a better segue than that, because joining us now is Ezra Spitzer, the executive director of NMCAN, which is an organization that partners with young people who have been impacted by CYFD and the foster care system. And also, I'd like to welcome Marissa Vigil and Hope Alvarado, who are youth leaders with NMCAN, to the program. Good morning, guys. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Marissa and Hope, I'd like to start with you guys. You both were either in foster care or impacted by CYFD intervention. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about what you think people should know about what it's like to be a kid who has been in your situation. Marissa?
Yeah, I think from my experience, aging out of the foster care system and being adopted at such a young age, I feel like I've experienced an interesting childhood, but it has definitely made me the woman I am today and then do the work that I do today. So I get to be that mentor and use my story to inspire and lift up other young people to feel free to share their voice in these spaces where they're supported and encouraged in the right way. And I think since I've got involved with NMCAN, they've allowed that safe space for me to do that and really gave me the confidence and just made me a stronger leader, a stronger mother, and a stronger advocate in my community. So I think A lot of times I don't like to share my story, but I think there's a lot of pieces that touched on the people that have spoke before us. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing, my experience with CYFD was that it wasn't a good experience because I lived in a rural area. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, there was lack of resources, lack of services, and felt very isolated mm-hmm. when it came to allowing me to have a voice and ask for what I needed or wanted. Many times they would listen to what my adoptive parents had to say or what they wanted. So that was very traumatizing for me to be sent back many times throughout being removed. And so beyond that, when I entered the system for good until I aged out at 18, I was connected to community. I was connected to young people who've experienced similar things. And I think the work that I've been doing for the past 8 years has been very powerful mm-hmm. and very eye-opening and healing for me, because it showed me the other side. And I've worked with CYFD, I've worked with NMCAN and other organizations for the past few years. So I think being able to see it on that other side, mm-hmm. I've been able to do reform work or pass laws and, or I don't know how to say it correctly, mm-hmm. legislature bills. And that is only because we are able to advocate and educate ourselves on those okay. at that level. Because you can ask a young person to show up in these spaces to do those things, but if they're not educated or supported in the right way, then mm-hmm. why are we asking our young people to be that voice if they are not properly skilled or properly prepared to be in those spaces to make those decisions that are going to affect youth beyond us?
Thank you for sharing that. It is time for a real quick break. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. I'll be back in a minute.
Support provided by Ruthie's Bagels, boiling a variety of bagels daily at the Rhubarb and Elliott Cafe, located inside the lobby of the Jewish Community Center on Wyoming in Albuquerque. Order online for pickup at ruthiesbagels.com.
Support comes from REDW, an Albuquerque-based and locally owned CPA and advisory firm dedicated to serving the needs of New Mexico businesses and individuals since 1953. Complete details about services at REDW.com.
Lil Watt artist Russell Wallace is sharing his new album, Unseated Tongues. It's a mix of pop and jazz that's sure to wake up the senses. Here's a sample of his musical creativity. Join us for our May Music Maker with Russell Wallace on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. What do you think about the reforms to our state's foster care system? There is still time to weigh in. You can call us at 277-5866. And I have a call from Roland in Santa Fe. Good morning, Roland. What is your comment? Good morning.
My comment is that, you know, in listening to the secretary and the attorney for her clients, I find it remarkable with some of the things that have been shared, that here we are in 2021 and we're still talking about the issues that were present when I was working for the state mm-hmm. in CYFD from 1980 through 2014. Mm-hmm. And, you know, CYFD, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to ever learn from the past, doesn't ever learn from the lawsuit that the ACLU brought and took CYFD to court, where we spent millions and millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And here we are still talking about close proximity, community-based services, families. It just drives me insane that somehow, and I don't know this secretary, and he talks, some good talk, I guess, doesn't impress me, because people out in the communities that aren't in Albuquerque that aren't in Santa Fe or aren't in Las Cruces just somehow are forgotten. And, you know, families, I think CYFD just gives it lip service. It's frustrating to hear this after all these years.
Well, thank you for calling in, Roland. Secretary Blaylock, what is your response to folks like Roland who say that we've been talking about this for a long time and it never seems to change?
Yeah, I think certainly, you know, as someone from the outside coming in, one of the things that I noted is there's definitely a policy fatigue when it relates to child welfare in New Mexico. There's just this sense that we've been working at this for so long and we're still, you know, what 49th in child well-being, like mm-hmm. at the bottom of many child well-being metrics nationally. And the only thing I can say is, I guess, two things. The first is what we pointed to earlier, which is the data does seem to show that we're turning the corner. And I know that that can be difficult to trust because of the longstanding problems and difficulties with child serving systems here in New Mexico. So I think, you know, totally okay. Let's remain skeptical, continue being sure that we're doing all of the things that we need to do. We do still have a long way to go. But for those of us in the work, I think there's reason for optimism because of how quickly some of these numbers have increased and improved since January of 2019. And then the second thing I'll say is that, you know, child welfare, it's a complicated social issue. Like, there's so many different contributing factors that can really lead to having a system that has trouble better serving kids. And some of the things we talked about under the last administration matter and will take years mm-hmm. for the state of New Mexico to recover. The most obvious one is the evisceration of the community-based mental health services network in the state of New Mexico and just rebuilding that. Even though we've made huge strides since 2019, it will still simply take time. And our children and families have experienced so much trauma. That's a service that they absolutely need. And so it's completely, absolutely urgent. You can see other data, sadly, that also show that, like, for example, New Mexico now has the highest mm-hmm. youth suicide rate based on numbers from 2018. And so this is an urgent need that we have to do. And then if I can, just really quickly, the third thing that Roland mentioned is services outside of Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, the pandemic has radically accelerated CYFD's partnership with a lot of communities throughout the state of New mm-hmm. Mexico, building community-based mental health services in partnership with tribes such as infant mental health programs with 8 Northern Pueblo and their tremendous leadership up there, and mm-hmm. working closely with San Felipe and their great behavioral health care work there as well. But really, I mean, McKinley County is another excellent example where CYFD and HSD worked with the local, the mayor of Gallup and the city manager there to build permanent supportive housing from soup to nuts. So go in, get the building, tie up the Medicaid funding, get in housing funding, bring in a provider and launch it to directly avoid homelessness for families and children out there and launch that. And we did that in about 6 weeks. From December until February. So just a great success story, and heading home, the provider out there and who's moved out there in McKinley County doing fantastic work with those individuals.
Well, thank you for explaining that. I do want to ask Hope Alvarado, who is another youth leader with NMCAN, which is an organization that partners with young people who've been impacted by CYFD. Good morning, Hope.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us speak on the show and to share a little bit about our experiences.
Thank you.
I wanted to go ahead. Go ahead.
You go right ahead, Hope.
Okay, I just wanted to go ahead and share a little bit about my experience within the system. And so, as Marissa had shared before, I'm going to be building off of a lot of what she already shared around the lack of infrastructure of support for young people mm-hmm. who go through the system, whether it's foster care or surviving, you know, incarceration facilities like the juvenile justice system, and or folks who are impacted just by the systems in general. I'm Dine. Mm-hmm. I'm a young person who grew up living on and off the streets. And when I was put in a position as a minor to not where I was on and off the streets. I didn't have any of the support that I needed. My family didn't have the support that they needed to be able to do, work to address the issues that we were struggling with as a family. I actually believe that several of the experiences that we had as a family resulted mm-hmm. because of the lack of support that we received. My family, I was under investigation with CYFD for about 10 years, mm-hmm. And I ended up aging out of their, CYFD housing voucher program for mm-hmm. young people who have been on the streets chronically. And I like to just share my story and that I was a young person who fell through the cracks. Mm-hmm. There were several instances when, I didn't trust the system because of my family's history as Native people, of Indian removal, as well as just like the experiences of my grandparents going to boarding schools and going to foster care and having experienced so much harm. I grew up understanding the system to be a very violent system. Mm-hmm. And so when CYFD was asking me questions and asking me about my family life and investigating my family life, I was very afraid to talk to them. And oftentimes, like the CYFD representatives didn't, offer to support my mom, who was a single parent, who was a teen mom with two kids. They didn't offer to support her and surround her in care, which I think would have been so much more helpful because the narrative that I had been told was that I was going to be taken away mm-hmm. From my community and from my family. And for that reason, I didn't know what to do. And I think that like a lot of other young people feel this way as well, that we are almost like running from the system. And so throughout this process, I was on and off the streets. I managed to get through high school and go and get my bachelor's even in college. And there were so many obstacles that I had as an independent student because I didn't have, the record or documentation of being a part of the system. But also when CYFD was asking questions about like my living situation, there was instances when the representative, for example, I was on the streets and I was like, okay, I'm trying to get into a shelter. And the CYFD representative was like, okay, well, I see that you're Native, mm-hmm. but also like, it's great that you're trying to get into a shelter. And because you're trying to get into a shelter, I'm going to discharge you. And I wasn't even in a shelter. So I don't know exactly like what their reasoning was to discharge me and close my case, but it was extremely frustrating because at that time there was a behavioral health crisis that was going on where all of the culturally grounded services were being taken away because of what Susana Martinez was doing mm-hmm. with consolidating those services to like four specific entities and getting rid of like over 50 of them, and I fell through the cracks. I didn't get any support. I was very blessed to come across NMCAN when I was on the streets. At the time, NMCAN didn't cater to young people in my situation, but they still like opened their arms and that I was a young person who was struggling to just get like basic things like food and shelter. And there was just absolutely no infrastructure within the current system to be able to support me. Also, often I heard young people express, and this is my experience as well, where like adults wouldn't hear us, wouldn't listen to us, wouldn't hear like the violence that we were experiencing within shelters, mm-hmm. but also even like on the streets trying to just access services mm-hmm. As minors. There was just absolutely no infrastructure for any of us to feel supported and cared for, as well as to just receive like basic necessities like shelter. Oftentimes there was just so much violence happening, whether it was on the streets or within these shelters and spaces, where the adults failed us, where the system mm-hmm. failed us. And this, I think, all goes back to the reality that the system and the foundation of this system is built on, white supremacy and settler colonialism and all of these other terminologies like capitalism, like a system that's based off of money and a system that's based off of profiting off of young people who, slip through the cracks or mm-hmm. young people who are struggling. And I think that that is something that we really need to be talking about. And this is something that I hear young people talking about a lot, is that, like, we know that the system was not created for us. And a lot of us have gotten to a point where we're like, you know what? We want a whole new system. Let's get rid of the system that's currently in place. We know it doesn't work. And all of the strides that folks try and do, like, oftentimes the people who helped me the most as a young person had to break their own rules to be able to help me. Because whenever, like, for example, Hogatis was shut down, my CSW was, my CSW was lost. And luckily she had added me on social media when she lost her job. So when she got into another position at Open Skies, she was able to find me and give me access to resources again and support me. Had she not tried to find me on social media, I don't think she would have, like, I would have gotten the care and support that I needed. But, like, that was just one instance where, like, literally the system had created barriers and obstacles for the service provider to support me. And it felt like everything was against us. And I was just very blessed that I came across other young people who, you know, wanted to create community and care about one another, no matter the placement, no matter the halfway houses, no matter the systems that we were engaged with. We managed to find each other and support one another. But that's just to say that, like, this system doesn't create safety nets for young people, but also its foundation is rooted in all of these things. And I believe that, you know, reform is helpful in, like, you know, supporting young people right now. But I think that the end goal that we need to be working towards is creating a system that is actually built for, you know, our communities, including the community, like, Native communities and Black communities and undocumented communities that are often left out of these conversations. Oftentimes inside, you know, services or service provider spaces, like, the only folks that I was around were, like, people who were not from my community. And I often wondered, like, you know, how do I gain access to my community?
Well, I want to put this question to Brian Blaylock of Secretary of CYFD. Brian, when you hear a story like Hope's about, you know, people who, kids who don't trust the system, who have very good reasons not to trust the system, can you tell me how is CYFD going to change to bring that trust back?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks, Hope, for your story. I think three quick things. I think first is that it's clear in New Mexico that we don't have a child welfare system that's set up for older youth. We have a child welfare system that's predominantly set up for babies. And that's a problem. It's also a problem because it has historically prevented CYFD from taking in the input and sharing power with those young people that are in our system so that we can build a system that that they can help us build. Because at the end of the day, that's the only way it'll be successful is if our system that is working with youth is also built by youth and has that feedback.
I'm sorry to have to cut you off, Brian, but that music has started, and that, unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. I'd love to continue this conversation. We probably will at another point, but thank you to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Therese Yannin, Brian Blaylock, Ezra Spitzer. Sorry we weren't able to talk to you a little bit more about NMCAN, Hope Alvarado, and Marissa Vigil. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Megan Kamrick screened your calls. Kaveh Movahed produced the show. I'm Ty Bannerman, and this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.